Welcome to Intersectional Feminism Desi Style, brought to you by Feminism in India. I'm Nishtha.
And I'm Pragya.
And we're your hosts for this season of the podcast.
So, Nishtha, Valentine's Week was just here, and how can we not talk about love, right? But, these days I hear people saying that love is the ultimate equalizer, especially with those pop culture representations where, you know, you see those poor girl meets rich guy tropes and they become equally rich or something. But I mean, really, is love really an equalizer? I mean, it's not, right? Because some of us consciously or subconsciously choose love, especially the ones that are socially sanctioned. And this kind of creates biases, which tries to tell us what is normal and what isn't. So yeah, so today we are going to talk all things love, and we have a very, very special guest, which Nishtha will introduce you all to.
Yeah, I mean, before I introduce my guest, it hurt that you talked about Valentine's Day because I was single again. But anyway, our guest for today is somebody who's doing some really different pioneering work in the field of love, if I may so say. We have with us Samar Halankar, who's an author and a journalist who's been in the industry for over 28 years now. He's worked with organizations such as India Spend, Indian Express, Mint, Hindustan Times, and has authored two books. He's also written for New York Times, The Globe and Mail, as well as Mint. In October 2020, he co-founded India Love Project, which he has in the past described as an attempt at unity, a chronicle of love outside the shackles of faith, ethnicity, and gender, which is perfect for our episode and for our podcast. So, Samar, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we charted this entire episode out calling it Modern Love. Before we get into the details of what it means to love in this age of modernity and, you know, technology, dating apps, social media, Samar, we want to first talk about the journey of India Love Project. You know, tell us when and how it started and what are its goals.
You know, in a country that we see as increasingly fractured by false narratives over religion and love, we see India Love Project as an attempt at unity, a chronicle of passion, as it were, outside the shackles of faith, caste, ethnicity, and gender. So India Love Project carries first-person accounts or narratives from offspring as well, of couples who surmount these hurdles, revealing to us the possibilities of love without traditional straitjackets, love that can serve possibly as a beacon of hope to others in the same situation. Now, you know, we know that interfaith love is relatively rare in India. I think less than 10% of all marriages are intercaste, and only perhaps 2.2% or so may be interfaith. We don't have accurate data, but these are large numbers. And the point is that such marriages are more prevalent than we imagine, and as we are seeing on India Love Project as well. And I suspect that more young people, as more young people meet and mingle in educational institutions and at the workplace, the opportunities for such relationships are growing. So we hope that the stories at India Love Project can inspire, encourage, and guide those who choose this path. So we launched India Love Project right after the, you know, the Tanishq controversy. Tanishq was pressured to pull the ad, but we have been thinking about it for more than a year. We have always felt very strongly about the blatantly fake narratives and politically motivated hate mongering around interfaith love marriages in India. We knew this was false. We knew it was wrong. And that campaigns like the so-called Love Jihad were merely excuses to snatch agency from women, strengthen the hold of patriarchy, and perpetuate basically stereotypes and lies. So a year ago, as this Love Jihad nonsense worsened, we imagined a website, a place where couples who push these boundaries could share their stories, inspire others like them, and simply make us feel good about love. Now that it's been weaponized and normalized, the whole question of Love Jihad, three states now have laws to hinder interfaith marriages, even though these laws are constitutionally invalid. And the government has itself told Parliament that no such terms exist. The fact remains that it's out there. So we thought, what better way to counter something that is fake with something that is real? And nothing could be more real than the stories on India Love Project.
That's, you know, you've already breached one of the things that we really wanted to talk about. What, like, one of the motivating factors behind even this episode was, as you very rightly put it, the entire love jihad nonsense that's going on. But before we get into more details of that, so we're now sitting in 2021, and still, like you said, ideas around polyamory, open relationships, intercaste and interfaith love stories, they still seem extremely revolutionary. And what's frustrating is that on paper, we call ourselves modern and liberal and progressive, but we've all heard people using phrases like cast no bar or demanding brides and partners who are either professionally successful or just look exceptionally beautiful or whatever, what have you. So even if we don't preach it in public, and even if it's perhaps now happening more behind closed doors, some of us still have those reservations around the people that we quote-unquote fall in love with. So how do you think we can really transgress these inter-community barriers when it comes to love?
So there's no one clear answer to that, but I think to transgressing these barriers, and I don't know if they will ever be transgressed. But the point is, I think there are different kinds of love. You refer to the fact that people expect partners to look, be successful or look exceptionally beautiful. Well, many of the stories on India Love Project don't necessarily follow this ideal. There are some where the love stories seem perfect, where people are beautiful and successful, etc. But there are so many where it's very clear that they have charted their own path and that they have gone completely against the norms that society enforces and expects of many of us. So there are these many of these wonderful stories, I think, from people from all kinds of backgrounds who have come together and have made a life for themselves. So I think the only way to cut through all these barriers is to follow your heart. And I think that's what many of the couples have on India Love Project have shown. That if you follow your heart, there is certainly a beautiful life that you can make for yourself. It takes courage and it takes patience. That's what they appear, their stories appear to tell us.
A very big part of modern love is technology, right? And we keep calling it love online. But, you know, the online space sometimes has been like a catalyst in helping people meet other people through dating apps, through social media. But it has also had its own drawbacks. Now that we also are an organization who works in the online space, we hear so many stories of gender-based violence on the internet. And as someone whose project is also, say, I mean, India Love Project is also online on the internet space, how do you feel about technology and social media's influence on love and relationships?
Technology and social media are an inescapable part of our lives. There are very, very, very few people who do not keep their phones with them all the time and do not keep looking at them. Whether we like it or not, technology is now an inseparable part of life, and by extension, love. From emojis to sexting, a large part of courtship is online. Our stories too, of course, spread through social media, and it is through social media that people hear of stories that inspire them to write to us. As for the downsides, I personally think technology does take something away from spontaneity and the ability to connect with our devices. But that's just me. I'm, you know, reasonably old-fashioned. I don't pick up my phone in the morning. I read 5 newspapers. So this is really up to the people involved. If you've grown up with a cell phone, so be it. Who are we to preach to them? So technology can help. It can hinder. But like every other technology, like everything else, I think the cell phone and social media, their impact depends on how you use them and how you deploy them in your lives.
Yeah, I don't relate to that. I'm one of those people who checks her texts first thing in the morning, and I'm kind of embarrassed to be admitting that here. But I do understand what you're saying, that even for somebody who probably doesn't do that, the phone and social media has still become extremely pervasive, especially for like a lot of us who in the digital space are almost now operating off of this medium. So coming back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the whole love jihad thing, there's a sense that love is a personal choice. And, you know, I could meet somebody, I could like them, we could reciprocate, we may come to an understanding about each other and yada, 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 you know how it goes. But then we see these cooked up ideas of love jihad being overwhelmingly circulated amongst people, and love seems more like a political choice. So what do you think? Is it personal or political to love? And can we find a middle ground between the two extremes?
Okay, first of all, I think there's no question of finding any middle ground, because love isn't an extreme. The politicization of love is an extreme. That is the extreme. Love is normal. I think I'd like to be really clear about that. That, as you yourself said, these are fake narratives. So how come it suddenly become, something that is being compared to something that is legitimate and true? So I think first we must remove this aspect from our argument entirely. Love was political in the days when there were kings, queens, and maharajas in India. Love was political in those days when we've seen marriages between, Rajput kingdoms and the Mughal Empire. There were Rajput princes who married Mughal princess. And that was when love was political. These were political alliances. There is nothing political about love itself today. The discourse around love has been made political, but love itself is not political. It is still between two individuals. Of course, in India, it's of course between two families as well. But that is still a question of society and community, and not politics. Politics is being infused and being forced on us. Is being infused into it and is being forced on us from the outside by unscrupulous politicians who are floating this love jihad nonsense, which has no basis, I would like to emphasize, in fact or in law.
So I agree that perhaps finding a middle ground between the politics of where our country is perhaps today and what it's like to actually personally love somebody, there's no sort of comparison and you can't find a middle ground. But where I was also coming from, you brought up an interesting point where you said love perhaps in our country, or not just our country, but in also different cultures like ours, is more about not just love between two people, but between two communities, two families. And that's something that's, as a young woman, I can tell you, even like growing up in the modern world has really been drilled into me that love is not just between you and whoever you may like. It's about whether or not the society matches, whether or not culture matches, even economic status to some level, whether or not that matches. And that then tends to have an effect on how we view people, right? How we may decide that, oh, you know, there's no point in one sentence that I've heard like a lot of my friends say is, there's no point in going ahead with this because this is not going to end up anywhere. And in that sense, then love does become political, because if I'm thinking about institutions that I may exist in before choosing a partner, don't you think there then love becomes a political choice?
So love in that sense, of course, is a political choice when it involves, if you're talking of parents and communities. That is an inescapable part of being Indian, I assume. But again, that it's, I understand that people are bound by how they've been raised, by the communities they live in. But I think eventually a defining aspect of relationships like this is courage. Unless you have courage, I don't think you can go forward with a love affair. It is possible, of course, And it's certainly, I've seen that with my own parents, that is certainly possible to fall in love after you've had an arranged marriage, and you've seen it with quite a few people. But I think these are still exceptions. The fact is that if you truly want to follow your heart, I think you do tend to fall in love before you make get others involved in this relationship. So I think, you know, in that sense, that it's entirely up to you to if you're fine with the fact that you know your families and your community is going to get involved, then so be it. Who am I to judge you? But if you ask me personally, I think there is a certain freedom that must be allowed to love and to passion, unhindered by the people and the community around you.
So we talked so much about social sanction already, but you know, like you mentioned, that it's also a part of Indian society where there is this expectation that the social or the society will accept your relationship. And also in general, like, I mean, coming from a personal point of view, I also would want my family and friends to engage and, you know, bond with my partner and just have like a normal life. But, you know, usually this does not happen because this sort of open-mindedness, this sort of progressiveness comes from a certain kind of privilege, from certain kind of intergenerational privilege, and even in a lot of this rich and educated households, we don't see such open-mindedness or acceptance, right? And we read so much about honor killings and lynchings when people across caste, religious or class boundaries have attempted at just being together and celebrating their love. So, Samar, do you receive entries only from, say, the privileged spaces, or have you received entries from, you know, different backgrounds where you know obviously realize that these people have had it harder and on many levels?
So I have to admit right away, there is some self-selection involved, simply by the fact that India Love Project currently runs only in English. So I think that is definitely a hindrance. But even so, and I suspect if we open it up to other languages, we'd get people of many more varied backgrounds. But we already have people of many varied backgrounds, and we ourselves are constantly surprised by the kind of people who write in, who suggest other stories, stories of other people, etc. We have had people from every social strata currently. There have been, you know, some couples who are really not middle class at all, are lower middle class to poor, so to say. And with really tough lives. And their stories have been particularly inspiring because many of them do not appear to have the kind of support that some other couples from more privileged backgrounds have. There are many more stories of those that we are not capturing, that's for sure. But I think that will require an expansion of India Love Project into other languages. And that requires funding. That's something we don't have. This is entirely something that we are doing by ourselves. But even if you look at the kind of cases that have been filed in Uttar Pradesh, let's just take one example. In the last couple of months, despite this love jihad law, young people are still falling in love. And of the 86 people or so who have been arrested currently, those 86 people are a microcosm of the fact, a microcosm of those who are falling in love despite all the barriers, despite their backgrounds. And it's an indication that people will continue to fall in love despite the hurdles that you throw up at them. So as far as we are concerned, yeah, we are limited in a sense. Because of the language, because of the fact that we are entirely online. But I think that will change if we can simply add on more languages. But the differing backgrounds are evident even now if you go through many of the stories that are on the site.
So I just wanted to know, Samar, that whether India Love Project is also open for singles and people who have been in love and say they are out of love now, because see, I also have a lot of caste experiences to share, but I've been out of love and I have, you know, I've had a lot of kind of really difficult experiences when it came to relationships and partnerships, especially because it around this entire social sanction kind of, I don't know, kind of prejudices. So, yeah, so is India Love Project also open for singles?
No, it's not. Simply because there are enough, there are lots of forums for that. Currently, what we are doing, and perhaps we might in the future, I don't know, but currently we are very limited by the fact that these stories that culminate, in marriage, essentially. There may be a couple, especially, intergender stories that not exactly marriage simply because it is not recognized in India. But we're currently constrained by the fact that eventually they end in marriage. Otherwise, you know, it's completely open. What we do get, however, is a lot of communication from people who are not married, but are in relationships, interfaith relationships, and are struggling with the various aspects of those relationships, legal, social, personal. So there we certainly have, we thought as a second stage, we set up a support structure for people like this, because this was supposed to be a space for interfaith couples and not necessarily interfaith couples after marriage. Those people are not married, of course, and we now have a whole a list of volunteers, about 15 lawyers and two or three organizations that help with mental health counseling, etc. So that space is certainly available for those who are who are single and are in the process of finding love. But those who feature eventually are those who have gotten married.
Samar, you just mentioned that there are couples who are same-sex couples or queer couples who don't even get recognized in society and therefore, like, in marriage and by law and things like that. And as from personal experience as a feminist media organization, I can tell you that with the content that we put out, which is, you know, veering even slightly off course with what popular narrative is, we are often shut down by people, say, in the comments, in our DMs, who are telling us that, you know, what you're talking about is against what India stands for, as if they are the, you know, gatekeepers of everything that in of all Indianness. However, what has the response to India Love Project been overwhelmingly positive on the internet, or have there been instances where say a couple has come out and put their story and, you know, they've just probably faced some sort of backlash from the IT cells that are now so very heavily in operation?
So this is a very interesting question, because I've been asked this very often. The response has been not just overwhelmingly, but almost completely positive. We have had thousands and thousands of responses. If you simply go through the site, you'll find any number of responses. Of those, we can count, I think, less than 10 trolls who keep coming pretty much almost every day. These trolls pop up. And they specifically pop up when there is a Muslim man and a Hindu woman involved. And of course, there are the usual incoherent, bigoted rubbish saying that what about the invaders, the Muslim invaders came, and you are now marrying them, etc. This kind of rubbish. Or they say, oh, you Hindu, you couldn't find a Hindu man, that's why you married one of the invaders. Rubbish like this. But first, the thing that's interesting is that many of our other readers themselves shut these people down. Sometimes it's the couple themselves who shut them down. But the most significant part is that there are so few of them. This may have something to do with the fact that we are on Instagram and not on, say, Twitter, where things might have been very different. Instagram is generally a warmer and fuzzier place, so to say. But I think the most powerful aspect of these stories is that they are real. And how much can you troll something that is completely real? Because these are people who are sharing their own stories. Many of these people have told us that it's taken them a lot of thought before they came out and shared these stories. And many say that they feel in the current environment where something like love jihad is being normalized, it was important for them to share their love. And of course, as far as the Hindutva trolls go, they are only focused, as I said, on the fact that there is a Hindu woman and a Muslim man. And the other thing they say is, oh, how come you don't have the opposite? But we do have a heck of a lot of the opposite. And when it does show up, of course, then they have nothing to say. But I think overall, going a little further from this whole Hindu-Muslim business, I think the point is it shows you India Love Project, the stories on India Love Project show you how diverse love stories have become in India. And I think each story celebrates and inspires more like it. And I think that's the power of what we're trying to do.
Now, before we actually finish this story, we can't let you go away without asking you, has there been any story that stayed with you? What is one story that you absolutely love?
Oh, yes. There's no question about that. There are some stories that have stuck with me. One of those that I remember, because it was so unconventional and so radical for the time, was the story of Salma Siddiqui and Krishan Chandar. This was in the late 1950s, just after independence. And Rehana Munir, who wrote to us, she wrote about her grandmother, her paternal grandmother, Salma Siddiqui, who, for long had admired Krishan Chandar, who was a leading light of the progressive writers movement. And her father's friend. He was older than her by about 20 years and had been a fan of his Urdu short stories and novels. She was also the mother of a young son, Rehana Munir's father. And he was a much respected public intellectual in Bombay and a father of three. And that's when they fell in love. And they went through everything, all the anger that followed, the judgment, the guilt, etc., they married. So, a Muslim woman from a respectable family left her lawyer husband and married a much older Hindu, right? It was unheard of. And anyway, until he died in 1977, they had 20 years. They had a married life, which Munir said is the stuff of family lore. And she said she's preserved a wooden statue of Saraswati that her grandmother kept among her books. A legacy of a relationship with a second husband with whom she shared a deep love for the what is now increasingly an older syncretic Hindustan. So that, to me, was one of the most remarkable stories. There are other tremendous, there are tremendously engrossing other stories as well. But this, I thought, was particularly powerful because it went against every possible social norm of the time. I suspect if something like that happened today, it would be even more difficult. And in fact, many of the older stories appear to be far more radical than many of the present-day stories that we have.
Oh no, now I feel all fuzzy on the inside. But thank you so much, Samar, today for being with us and sharing so many wonderful, amazing stories about love. It was a genuine pleasure to be speaking to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fabulous talking to you.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Intersectional Feminism Desi Style. As always, we'd love to hear what your thoughts are, so do let us know. Next to next Thursday, we're going to be talking about the trans rights movement in India and what we can do to be better allies. Until then, thanks so much for listening in and do tune in for our next episode.